This podcast was first broadcast on Mix 92.6. Go to mix92.6.com to find more Environment Matters podcasts. And if you enjoy what we do, to find out how you can support the station, which is run entirely by volunteers. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Welcome to Environment Matters with me, Amanda Yorworth. Environment Matters is the show that brings you news on issues of sustainability and the environment from around Hertfordshire and from further afield. Biodiversity. Something that we hear quite a lot about, isn't it? We thought it was a good thing, and it was, when last December the United Nations Biodiversity Conference, known as the COP15, ended in Montreal with a landmark agreement to guide global action on nature. It was called the CONMIG-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework. On a more local scale, biodiversity action plans are an internationally recognised way of addressing and reversing our effect on the natural world and are used by governments, councils, in fact, all sorts of bodies. It's all about biodiversity, isn't it? But are we only looking at half of the picture? Gabriel Roberts is a long-time St. Albans resident and works in environmental education. He's concerned that whilst we are aware of dwindling biodiversity and working hard to do something about it, we need to think more about dwindling bioabundance. I spoke to Gabriel and I started by asking him to explain his concerns.
Yeah, when we see things in the news about biodiversity, it's very easy to think that what that's all about is simply declines in the number of species that are living around us. So whereas we might have had X number of birds living alongside us 10 years ago, we now have a smaller number of birds. That isn't the only thing that's going on, though, although it certainly is going on. There are also declines in the numbers of many species of animal, and these stretch back over very long periods of time. And what I think a lot of people don't realise is that 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 500 years ago, there were enormously greater numbers of many wild animals than there are today. And actually, throughout most of human history, people were living alongside really considerable abundances of wild animals in a way which is very unusual for people who are alive today.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose we're kind of a bit more aware about things that are already rare having dwindling numbers. But your point is actually that we shouldn't just be thinking about in the context of things that are very rare, but actually more things than that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you often get a focus in things like wildlife TPP programs on things that are very rare and unusual. And there can be a sense of achievement which goes with tracking down some very rare and hard to find animal. But it's not just that things are rare and on the brink. It's also that things that are very numerous are declining in numbers. So a good example here is swifts. 20 years ago, swifts were, you know, pretty common bird in the UK, not one I think that many environmentalists were terribly concerned about. And yet now there are red list species. They've got declining numbers. There are extensive conservation efforts in place to save them. And quite soon they could become something really quite rare that people are desperately seeking out. And I think what we need to be a little bit more aware of is the beginnings of the long-term population changes that can lead to a species going from being very abundant to very rare and hard to find.
Yes, indeed. I mean, when I think about swifts, I actually think, well, actually, there are quite a few of them around. But I think you think this are sort of like our baseline, our idea of what is abundant changes over
time.
Yeah,
it does. There's lots of scientific research on this. The term that often gets used to describe it is shifting baseline syndrome, which is a slightly controversial term because it's not quite clear whether what's being described should really be classified as a syndrome. But what scientists are getting at by using that term is the phenomenon whereby people tend to think that a natural or default population for a particular species is the one that they first encountered. So I remember seeing swifts when I was a kid, and I might think that the number of swifts that I saw at that time was a sort of natural number or a kind of starting point number of swifts. In reality, the number that existed then would probably have been lower than the number that exists 10 years before or 10 years before that or 10 years before that. And once you realise that actually populations change over very long historical periods, you start realising that your sense of where the baseline is in that data series actually can be quite misleading with respect to what's been happening over that longer time period.
So you've spoken about scientists and them understanding the shifting baseline phenomenon. But actually, as far as working out exactly what historical populations of various things used to look like, sometimes we don't have scientific records. So you've been looking to other sources, like literary or artistic sources, to give us an idea of what historical populations of things used to look like. Can you just give us a little bit more about that and a couple of examples?
Yeah, there's maybe a bit to fill in before coming to specific examples, and that's to do with how far back really reliable population data goes with respect to lots of different kinds of wild animal. In most cases, the data only really begins in the 1970s. So if you look at something like the Living Planet report published by the World Wildlife Fund in 2022, that gives a headline figure of wildlife populations decreasing by 69%. But it uses 1970 as a baseline because that's when really systematic data gathering began. There's obviously a huge amount that was going on before that starting point in 1970. But if you want to start finding out about what was going on in that earlier period, you have to go to other places because you haven't got the kind of detailed data gathered by naturalists in many cases. And there, things become a bit more complicated because you're just looking for what you can find. Now, in some cases, it might be things like shooting records or vermin control records. Fishing records sometimes go back a long way. Sometimes the accounts kept by organisations like the Hudson Bay Company for how many pelts were being taken from animals in the Canadian Arctic give you fairly detailed information stretching back into the 19th century. But those are the exceptions rather than the rules. So what I've been trying to do is have a look at what kind of information you can get from other sources. They might be allusions in literature, or they might be paintings where people are depicting how the countryside looked at the time. And there you really do find some extraordinary things. To give an example, Gavin Maxwell's famous book, Ring of Bright Water, about an otter that was kept by the author on the Western Highlands, contains a reference to the streams of the Western Highlands being so full of elvers, which are baby eels, that if you dipped a bucket, it would come up with more elvers in it than water.
And wasn't actually that long ago. That's not hundreds of years.
No. This is mid-20th century. But this is before a period of time in which eel populations in the UK have fallen by 95%. So to find that kind of phenomenon now is practically impossible. By the time he's writing, he's just remarking on it as something he comes across. Or to give another example, 1960s novel Kestrel for a Knave by Barry Hines, about a kid growing up in North England, describes some boys going and playing by a pond, and one of them filling an entire Wellington boot with tadpoles. It's quite rare to find tadpoles in anything like that sort of abundance these days. If you go back further in time, you might find someone like Daniel Defoe writing in the middle of the 18th century in a book called A Grand Tour Through the Whole Island of Great Britain, where he describes seeing what he thought was a million swallows waiting to migrate on the Suffolk coast. And the thing is, when you first encounter that, you might think that he's exaggerating or that's a kind of crazy number for him to report. You think, can there really have been a million swallows? And yet actually, the more of this kind of evidence you look at, the more you realise that, although there probably was some exaggeration, figures like that are not ridiculous. There may indeed have been a million swallows on the coast of Suffolk when Defoe was passing through. A few years ago, I think a flock of about 30,000 swallows turned up in Anglesey, and the BBC went and filmed it, and that was something people were really struck by as an example of abundance. But clearly, 30,000 compared to a million is a considerably smaller congregation of birds.
And when Daniel Defoe was writing about it, he was just writing about it as something he'd observed rather than an amazing thing that was unusual. It was just every day.
This is really interesting. A lot of the authors I found myself looking at when I was researching this topic report on abundances of wildlife that we would find extraordinary as quite every day. So Gilbert White, famous naturalist writing in Sussex in the later 18th century, in a book called The Natural History of Selborne, talks about rooks congregating over the South Downs in flocks of thousands. And that's not remarked on as anything unusual. For him, that's just like a regular occurrence. Or to give you another example, he talks about going on a boat trip on the Thames where he talks about seeing myriads of bats, so tens of thousands of bats. And again, he seems marginally impressed by this. He bothered to write it down, but he's not presenting it as the most extraordinary thing he's ever experienced, even though I don't think there's anywhere in the UK now you can see bats in anything like those kinds of numbers. And we tend to associate congregations of bats like that with nature documentaries from countries like Mexico. But we might not realise that congregations of bats like that actually were a not so unusual feature of the British countryside.
How about round here in Hertfordshire? Have you been able to find any examples of loss of bioabundance in Hertfordshire?
Yeah, I have. I mean, there's a few different ways of coming at this. One is to look at historical sources, and in Hertfordshire, systematic recording of bird sightings began around the end of the 19th century. So there's historical sources you can look at there. And then there were books written in the early 19th century on the birds of Hertfordshire that give you some quite interesting insights. And then you can also look back at sort of your own recent experience. I've lived in Hertfordshire my whole life, so I can give you some examples from my own experience. But looking back, say, towards the end of the 19th century, you read through historical sources, one thing that strikes you is how frequently birds are referred to that you really don't see around here these days. So nightingales, for example, frequently turn up in the historical sources. They are not now a breeding bird in Hertfordshire. They've gone locally extinct. Or to give you another example, nightjars used to breed in some considerable numbers at Mardley Heath near Welwyn. They aren't there anymore. Hawfinches, now a very, very rare breeding bird in the UK, are described in the 19th century as a commonly occurring breeding species in Hertfordshire. Redback shrikes, I now think there are about 3 breeding pairs of those in the UK each year, are described as being abundant in St Albans. Swifts are described breeding at a density of 10 pairs of swifts to each roof in some areas. Grasshopper warblers, now a pretty rare, hard-to-find bird, described in the 1870s as not uncommon in the area around Watford. Turtle doves, stone curlews, red starts, all things you could easily kind of live a whole life in Hertfordshire these days without seeing are described as fairly commonly occurring birds near Hitchin, again in the 1870s. Ring ousels, really quite a rare bird these days, regularly seen on migration through Hertfordshire in the late 19th century. And as you read through the sources, you encounter more and more of these things. But you also find big changes more recently in local history. So I found one reference from 1983 describing a roost of 3,000 house sparrows in what's now central Stevenage. And the idea of 3,000 house sparrows being in the same place is pretty extraordinary by current standards. And then if I think back to things I've personally experienced, I've seen quite striking declines in swifts, as I've already mentioned, but also house sparrows. They used to be far more common in my childhood than they are now. Bats, I've seen decline in St Albans since I was growing up. Moths, I definitely remember seeing more of them when I was growing up. And then if you think of other kinds of animal, mammals, for example, hedgehogs are far less commonly occurring than they used to be. I used to see live hedgehogs quite frequently in around St Albans, and now I generally only see the occasional one that's been killed by a car. Things like slow worms, frogs, toads, again, far more commonly encountered those when I was a child. I specifically know actually a bit of the Ver near where I grew up. There were definitely slow worms there when I was a kid. I was talking to people recently who'd done a biodiversity assessment on an allotment site, and they'd not found any of them there. So those declines that you detect reading the historical sources are actually continued into one's own experiences.
So how do you think that we should use your findings? How should they affect our conservation efforts?
First of all, I hope they just redouble our efforts to try and turn things around. I think once you start looking at some of these biodiversity questions through a historical lens, you start realising how substantially humans have reshaped things. And also at the same time, how much there could be in terms of wildlife if we approach the natural world differently. There's lots of evidence people like great abundance of wildlife. You know, they watch it on TV programmes, they read books about it, they go and seek it out on safari. I think if we realise that we could have a bit more of that actually where we live, we might be infused by that to take more of a part in conservation efforts. I suppose the other thing I hope arises from this kind of work is that people start realising the importance of small changes. So I think a lot of people realise that leaving grass uncut and digging ponds and preserving trees and not using pesticides and all these kinds of things can be really good for the environment and good for wildlife. They might not realise how large the collective effect of everybody adopting one course of action or another can have on wildlife populations.
Indeed, and I think that that's something for us all to remember, isn't it? So what we've spoken about so far is declines in bioabundance, where historically there was a lot more natural things than there are now. But are there any examples of the corner being turned and actually things increasing?
Yeah, there are. And I think this is really important because if we realise that we can boost wildlife populations through sensible courses of action, we may feel more optimistic about our ability to change things in the future. So a really striking example here is with birds of prey. So if you look back at the 19th century sources I've described, birds which we think of as quite common now, like buzzards, are pretty much absent from those records. And that's because gamekeepers and farmers used to persecute these birds extremely intensively. And yet now, in and around Stourbans, you can see red kites and buzzards easily. We've got peregrines nesting on Stourbans Cathedral, something which was unthinkable back in the 1960s when their population was depleted through DDT. So there are these success stories that can give us some hope. Goldfinches have increased in abundance and moved into people's gardens. So it's not all a one-way street. Actually, with the right kind of support, wildlife populations can be remarkably resilient and actually bounce back remarkably successfully. So I hope we will see changes like that occurring across a wide variety of other species.
What a lovely positive note to end on. Gabriel, thank you so much indeed for explaining all that to us.
Cheers. Thanks very much for having me.
I was talking there to Gabriel Roberts. So do you have any examples of your own of local bioabundance that we've quietly lost? I was listening to Gabriel and I was that kid with a welly full of tadpoles. I'd love to see the return of amphibians in the numbers that we had then so that children now could enjoy what I did. I was also wondering what might be the abundances that we currently enjoy without even knowing about it that perhaps future generations might be amazed by. How about lawns full of daisies and dandelions or perhaps snails and woodlice under every stone? Do send me your thoughts. You can get in touch via email. I'm on amanda.yorworth@mix926.com or look for Environment Matters on Mix 92.6 on Twitter and on Facebook. And if you want some tips on how to be part of the return of some of that amazing local bioabundance that Gabriel was talking about, then we've heard lots of excellent advice from guests here on Environment Matters. Do check out the podcast page of mix926.com and listen to any shows that you have missed. You might also find helpful local wildlife group, the Wilderhood Watchers website, wilderhoodwatch.org, where they show how small actions that neighbours can be just what nature needs to return, just as Gabriel suggested. I'll be back with you at the same time next week, but until then, thank you for listening.